My reading this morning, you may notice that the reading and the sermon almost always will flow right into each other. The story begins in the reading, so you have to keep it in mind during the musical interlude. So a story called The Voice, The Flood, and The Turtle. It's a Caddo Indian myth. The Caddo used to live in what's present-day Oklahoma and Arkansas before becoming overcome, before being overwhelmed by changes as monstrous as anything that you'll hear in this story. Once there was a chief whose wife, to the fear and wonder of the people, gave birth to four little monsters. The elders said, "These strange children will bring great misfortune. It would be better to kill them right now for the sake of the tribe." "No way will we kill them," said their mother. "These children will turn out all right by and by." So our story begins with the ordinary flow of life and society is disrupted by a strange event. Four monsters have been born when a normal child was expected. We see at once that this society has several layers of authority. We know there's a chief who has power, though we never hear his voice. There are the elders who expect to be listened to if not obeyed. There's the chief's wife who shares some of that power and asserts considerable authority in her own right. When she says, "No way will we kill them," it's her word that carries. She sets her prediction against that of the elders. They say the strange children will bring misfortune, but she says they'll be fine kids in time. We continue, but they didn't turn out all right. The small monsters grew fast, much faster than ordinary children, and became very big. They had four legs and arms each. They hurt other children. They upset teepees. They tore up buffalo robes. They defouled people's food. A wise man who could see things in his mind which had not yet happened said, "Kill these strange bad things before they kill you." But their mother said, "Never. They'll be fine young men someday." Now we're told of another kind of authority which this society recognizes, a seer, a man who can see things that have not yet happened. He's a little different from the elders. His advice is more specific: kill them or else they're going to kill you. Still, it's plain that his word is far from law. He can give very strong advice like the elders, and like them, he expects people to at least listen to his voice. But that's all. His authority is in no way final or decisive. The voice of the chief's wife is more than enough to override his suggestion and to keep him quiet for a long time. When you have authority, it's your predictions, which you anticipate, that counts. Your version of the future. Your voice. Even the boy monsters enjoy some of the benefits of authority. Born into the chief's family, one or all of them may be destined to become chiefs themselves, no matter how they look. They would no doubt have some place in the authority structure of this society if its way of life could continue undisrupted. But the monsters themselves are about to disrupt it. Being born into the family of the chief doesn't justify their behavior, but it does give them some slack, even when they begin to act as well as look like monsters. And a little slack is all they need to do what they'll do next. Let's take a moment of slack ourselves and relax a moment as we listen. Thank you. recognize where have all the flowers gone. And the peat cedar grape. Well, what makes something a monster? Two monster stories today, so it's good to maybe think about what makes a monster. It's not being extra big or extra small or strangely shaped that makes you a monster. A kindly giant would not be a monster. A dwarf with three horns but a heart of gold would not. Great size or peculiar smallness don't make you a monster when other human qualities bring these into balance. But the boys in our story don't have these qualities. There's something too much about them and something too little. There's not enough of something that they would need to make them human. It's part two of our story. I call it the monster period. They never became fine young men, those boys. Instead, they started killing and eating people. At that point, all the men in the village rushed at them to do away with them, but by then it was too late. The monsters had become too big and too powerful to be killed. They grew taller and taller. One day they went to the middle of the camp and stood back to back, one facing east, one facing south, one facing west, and one facing north. Their backs grouped together and they became one. As they grew higher and higher, most people took refuge near the monster's feet where the huge creatures could not bend down to catch them. But people who stayed farther off were seized by mile-long arms and killed and eaten. The four monsters, now grown together, rose up in the clouds and their heads touched the sky. I suppose we can say monsters are as monsters do. A child might define a monster as something that eats people, and that's what starts to happen here. But this is not an ordinary link in a natural food chain. Instead, it's a disruption of all order, natural and social. The four offspring of the chief's family demand more and more. At first, they seem to want attention, upsetting teepees, befouling food, and so on. Now that their power has grown to immense proportions, we see that what they want, all that they want, is everything. The environment for a plate, and the people for their food. Whatever authority the monsters might have derived from the old sources, tradition, wisdom, family of birth, that's been replaced by a new kind of power, overwhelming brute force. Here we see something very different in kind from the old sources of power. Now we really do have a monster. Taking their start in the human world, the four brothers depart from it. Through too much of the worst of what's human and too little of other human qualities, they undergo a change of kind. They're not people at all anymore. They're now too strong for the people to overcome. They've unified the strength and the being of four into one. Now, my friend and colleague, Ted Tollefson, once said this about the name Unitarian. We are lovers of unity, animated by reverence for the unity of life. And that unity, and this is very important, is not imposed from without by any supernatural or mechanical cookie cutter. It grows from within, in its own time, in its own way. The sixth Unitarian Universalist principle affirms the goal of world community, with peace, liberty, and justice for all. Not unification of the world at any price. There's a big difference between unity and unification. There's also a tendency to confuse them. Did you ever tell anyone that you attended a Unitarian church and they thought you were talking about the Unification Church? A little bit of difference? A little bit of difference there. Unification is a parody of that unity which grows from within in its own time, in its own way. But it can be seductive to the untrained eye. If I heard of a church that was called the Church of Universal Unification, you would see me running in the other direction from that one. In today's story, unification is imposed by something much worse than a cookie cutter. It's no community, but a single thing, which we become one with only as we pass through its digestive tract. The unified monster takes up position in the middle of camp, in the center of community life, taking the center of the world by force. This parody of unity begins to receive a parody of reverence from the people that it devours. It's got them in, what was that expression, shock and awe. How could anyone think of anything else? Story continues. As they grew higher and higher, most people took refuge near the monster's feet, where the huge creatures could not bend down to catch them. But the people who stayed off farther were sealed by mile-long arms, killed and eaten. The four monsters, now grown together, rose up to the clouds, and their heads touched the sky. Here's a graphic image of people living under a tyrant. Literally. Let's consider the creature from the top down. Its heads reach the sky, so it's in a good position to do surveillance. But can it really see the lives that it controls? It can bellow out roars or maybe commands, but can it really communicate with the people? Its hands and arms can reach and take for a mile in any direction, but can they create? It has no back anymore. It's all a seamless front. It's all front. Can you walk like that? Can you move? We're told that the monster cannot bend. Then how can it lie down? Can it ever rest or sleep? This monster has no dream or vision. It's got nothing but appetite. And I don't know, maybe that looks like vision to some people. Appetite with no end in sight. Maybe that's impressive. Now let's consider how the people near the monster's feet live their lives. There's a sort of safety down there. Some parody of little freedoms, maybe we should say some little privileges. There's probably not much fresh food. What choice do we have but to eat what the monster does and each other, or else what the monster has already eaten? Those who survive near the feet may envy the dead. To use a rich term that was popular around the time of the Vietnam War, the living are almost as wasted as the dead. Remember that term? Wasted? You never heard that before that war. Wasted, forced into the condition and the position of waste. We don't know if the monster has four digestive systems or if its four mouths lead to one gut with one opening below, but I think it must have been a very filthy place near the monster's feet. Filthy with human lives that have been wasted, body and soul. Tyranny does that to people. Sociologist Richard Sennett writes that one of the oldest uses of the word tyranny in political thought is as a synonym for sovereignty, when all matters are referred to a common sovereign principle or person. That principle or person tyrannizes the life of a society. This governing of a multitude of habits and actions by a sovereign authority of a single source need not arise by brute coercion. It can equally arise by a seduction, so that the people want to be governed by a single authority who can stand above them all. Nor need this seduction involve one person as tyrant. An institution can rule as a single font of authority. A belief can serve as a single standard for measuring reality. I can't believe that Richard Sennett never read that story. I wanted to tell you. A single person or principle can tyrannize us. That tyranny can arise from brute coercion, an outside power imposing its shape like a cookie cutter on our lives, or by a subtle seduction. Can you think of some of the examples? Any persons you can name who have coerced or seduced their people, or both? What institutions have tyrannized our world? What beliefs? What about those wars? Those wars on drugs or terror? When do such obsessions become a form of terror themselves? What about when it defines any strenuous criticism of national policy as treason if voiced at home, or if voiced abroad as giving aid and comfort to the enemy? When it dominates all public discourse and justifies all decisions. Have we ever lived in a time like that? You could take our four-in-one monster standing in the center of things to stand for the legislative, executive, and judiciary branches of a government merged together with corporations. Or you could see them as church, state, markets, media, which should maintain creative tension with each other, competing to serve the people, to serve them rather than control them. Imagine any four such faces that you will, and then ask, has there ever been a monster period in our own history? Or more than one? And could one come again? You remember how people greeted each other in Germany under the Third Reich? Remember how? They spoke someone's name. Right? Wow. When crowds start chanting a name, anybody's name, I start to get worried. Start to get worried. Watch out when the name becomes the answer to every question. An institution, Sennett writes, can rule as a single font of authority. A belief can serve as a single standard for measuring reality. Tyranny is too much referred to too little. It's a matter of all referred to one at all times. It's an attempt to unify life in a way that does violence to any natural living unity. The multitude of habits and actions which make up human life are far too much to refer to one person, one institution, one belief, one principle, one event, no matter how shocking. Though they live at the monster's feet, the people have no real contact with it. Its head is in the clouds or the fog. They may feel like they're in touch with each other, but can they have any satisfying contact while they're being coerced or seduced by this single thing? Let's see where the story takes us next. Well, then, the man who could see into the future heard a voice telling him to set up a hollow reed and plant it in the ground. The man did, and the reed grew bigger and bigger very fast. In no time, it rose to touch the sky. The man heard the voice saying, I'll make a great flood. When the signs of bad things coming appear, you and your wife climb up inside this hollow cave. Be naked as you were born, and take with you a pair of all the good animals in order to save them. The man asked, what sign will you be sending? Watch for a cloud of birds, said the voice. One day the man looked up and saw a big cloud made of birds traveling across the sky. At once he and his wife moved into the hollow reed, taking with them all the animals that they wished to save. Then it began to rain and did not stop. Waters covered the earth and kept rising until only the top of the hollow came and the heads of the monsters were left above the surface. Well, this sounds a little bit like the Bible's flood story, And we'll talk about that story in a few weeks. But let's stick with this story right now. Remember the last time that the man who could see into the future was involved in a crucial decision? He spoke his own mind and said to the monster children, "Get rid of them before they kill you." He was right about becoming danger, but he spoke too soon. Before the other people could see what the shape of the danger really was. But now, instead of talking so fast, he listens. He asks questions. He's told to watch and wait and prepare. He hasn't been justified, but he's been changed. He was not allowed to kill the children, but now he and his wife are allowed to choose what will live. All of the good animals, meaning that all animals today must be good ones, even if we don't find them pleasant. So humans will now have a responsibility for saving more species than their own, a species-specific, special human responsibility to all life, a responsibility which only now can be recognized and understood. We couldn't see it before. Stuff had to happen first for us to realize it. The two people will survive by becoming as naked as they were born. I don't think that this is because their clothing would crowd the hollow reed. Rather, it means that the man and his wife and the good animals, once the flood is over, will live their lives twice born, and birth is a naked event. Hereafter, whatever lives will live not a casual life, but a chosen life, a deliberate life, a saved life. Saved not according to the man's old violent imperative, but now in cooperation with the voice. Inside the hollow reed, the man and his wife heard the voice again. "Now I shall send Turtle to destroy the monsters." The monsters' heads were saying to each other, "Brothers, I'm getting tired. I can't keep standing much longer." The floods swirled around them with strong currents that almost swept them away. Then the great turtle began digging down underneath the monsters' feet. It uprooted them, and they could not keep their footing, but broke apart and toppled over. They fell down into the waters, one sinking toward the north. Is that right? One toward
north.
One toward left hand, the west. One toward the east, and one toward the south. Thank you for helping me to orient myself here. Hard to do when you come up from sailing. They fell in the fort. Fell four ways. And you know what happened? Then, and only then, the four directions came into being. Now we see that all of these events have served a purpose. What purpose? Well, the clue is in this way that the monster falls. It's not like a tree falling or a tower collapsing. Instead, we witness the creation of the four directions. There were no directions before the rise of the monster or its fall. Before the monster, a way of life of a sort existed, but life had no direction as such. During the monster period, all of that changed. There was one direction and one only. All of life was directed toward the tyrant. There was no way of life anymore, and really, no way to live. The fall of the monsters brings the four directions into being. Now, life is oriented. The new world is not like the old one. It's a world that knows more than a single way of life. It has a history of tyranny, then destruction, and now salvation. Now, the world itself is twice born and self-conscious. Self-aware. The story's not over yet. After the monsters had drowned, The waters subsided. First the mountaintops reappeared, then the rest of the land. Next came hard-blowing winds that dried the earth. The man climbed down to the bottom of the hollow reed and opened the hole at its foot. He looked out, he stuck out his hand, he felt around, and he said to his wife, "Come on, everything's dry." The wife said, "Husband, there's nothing here, and we're naked. How shall we live?" The man said, "Go to sleep." They lay down and slept. And when they woke the next morning, all kinds of herbs had sprung up around them. The second night while they slept, trees and bushes grew. Now there was firewood to keep them warm and all kinds of woods for making bows, arrows, whatever they needed. During the third night, green grass covered the earth and animals appeared to graze on it. The man and his wife went to sleep a fourth time and woke up inside a grass hut. They stepped out and found a stalk of corn. Then they heard the voice say, "This will be your holy food." They told the woman how to plant and harvest the corn and ended by saying, "Now you have everything you need. Now you can live. Now you will have children and form a new generation. If you, a woman, should plant corn and something other than corn comes up, then know that the world will come to its end." After that, they never heard the voice again. Plant corn, and if something other than corn comes up, it's over. This prophecy recalls the birth of monsters when a child was expected. You could say that it anticipates another monster period, that such times come in cycles. You could relate it to questions about the dangers of genetically engineered foods or find more parallels to the Bible, but that's not what interests me here. This story is not told as the record of one couple or one family. The story assumes that the woman did plant, the couple did reproduce, and we are their descendants. We grow from those who listen to the voice and learn. We grow from those who dreamed and survived. What I hear in this story is something about the spiritual basis for making great changes in our way of life, and what people who want to change must both do and not do. We can't just stay focused on the problem. We can't give our total attention to the monster. What tyrannizes you claims your whole mind all the time. Don't give it. Don't give it up. Seize your freedom of thought and attention. This is a matter of watching, waiting, and listening, not expecting to get your answers from any time. It's a turning of attention to the voice. Still small voice, or that big thundery voice. We never learn whose voice it is that speaks to the people who survive. Is it God or some great spirit? The unconscious or a deeper consciousness or imagination? All we know of this voice is that it speaks, and the people hear and listen and engage with it in the midst of their distress. After it warns them about the corn, they never hear from it again, at least not in that generation. Whatever it is, the voice does not rule or direct their lives in the same way that the monster did. It puts the burden of authority on the people themselves, a different sort of authority than any we saw at the beginning of the story. How should we live? The answer we hear is, go to sleep. After the fall of the monster, the people repeatedly seek to address their problems by going to sleep, by taking rest, and by dreaming. It's an old story, that's true. But dreaming may still be the best way to enter a new world and choose new directions. to live strongly oriented lives without domination by any tyrant. Tyrants can seize and devour, but not create. Tyrants can eavesdrop, but not listen. Do surveillance, but not see. They can't bend, and they sure can't admit mistakes. Maybe they can learn to sleep standing up, but I don't believe that they can do it. I don't believe they can dream. And that makes all the difference in this story. So may it be in our stories as well.